I want to maximize the rate of response while not asking people to give feedback that they didn't feel was critical or key, right? So I'm not trying to push you like, hey, everybody, you need to reply no matter what. You've got to tell me something.
Welcome to Email Swipes, where we peek behind the scenes at the emails that catch your attention and earn their place in your swipe file. Every other week, we'll talk to an email expert about an experiment they ran, and in the following episode, we'll dive into the strategies and methods used in the email so you can inform and inspire your own email work. I'm Nikki Elbaz, the copywriter behind winning emails for 8- and 9-figure SaaS and e-commerce brands like Shopify, Four Sigmatic, and Sprout Social. And I know that hearing the background stories to these emails will help you turn pie-in-the-sky insights into plug-and play actions. Ready to make inspiration tactical? Let's go. First, let's read today's email. Howdy, Nikki. Super quick questions, and even a two-word answer is appreciated. Number one, how much value do you get from your free SparkToro account, and what are you using it for? Number two, what, if anything, holds you back from using SparkToro more, upgrading your account, and/or trying more searches? Casey and I read every word you send us and take that feedback to heart. Oh, and if it's been a while since you tried SparkToro, good news. We've got a bunch of upgrades, more data coverage, a new press tab, and enhanced text insights perfect for optimizing your Facebook ad campaigns, using in social posts, or to inform content strategy. Give it a spin. You've got 10 free searches every month. Thanks a bundle, Rand Fishkin. Yes, this is my actual email. P.S. If you want any tips on queries to try, applying results to your marketing tactics, favorite pasta recipes, etc., I'm always happy to help.
Rand, thanks so much for joining. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure, yeah. Thanks for having me, Nikki. I am the co-founder and CEO of two companies. One is SparkToro, which is in the audience research software space. And the other one is Snack Bar Studio, which is making an indie video game.
Super cool.
Yeah. Previously, I started and ran a company called Moz, which was in the SEO software space. And wrote a book that a lot of people know called Lost and Founder, which is a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. I like to help people do better marketing and build better companies.
Super cool. Yeah, I feel like that book was probably, and like, I mean, Moz was huge as well, but I feel like your book really put you, it's funny, it's a Lost and Found guide, but I feel like it put you on the map to be all punny.
I mean, the hope is, yeah, after the journey, right, of Lost and Founder, that like I found myself a little bit more, found things that make me happy and also make my companies more able to have the success that they promise.
Mm-hmm. Which is so huge. I feel like when we get started in the digital space, we're so excited to just impact and, you know, be successful. And then it's like, wait a second, what is this giving me in my life? And then that turns around into the company and feeds the company and gives you real success. So it's a pretty nice loop.
When it works.
Right, exactly. Nothing always works. Nothing ever always works. So you might as well be happy while you're doing it.
I mean, this is certainly a huge part of the shift between my early career, right? My 17 years at Moz versus the last few years with SparkToro and now Snack Bar, which is just the prioritization of different things, right? Moz was growth at all costs, mm-hmm. blitzscaling, hypergrowth, trying to be a billion-dollar company, raised tons of venture capital, and made promises to those investors that we would 10x their money, right? And mm-hmm. I think, you know, Moz was more successful than the vast majority of venture investments and still not successful, which is by the sort of promise that you make. I don't even think, my suspicion is Moz didn't even get its investors 2x their money, maybe right around 2x their money.
Wow.
Yeah, that's obviously not the rate of return they're looking for.
Right. That's very sobering. Huh.
Yeah, frustrating.
Yes. Okay, so pivoting to this email that I got from SparkToro. First of all, I'm actually just curious because you mentioned like growth at all costs and all that. So has this kind of feedback request and email and more personal sort of email, is that a shift from the way things were at Moz?
It's interesting. It's almost a throwback. In the very early years of Moz, I wrote almost all the emails personally and sent them out very personally. I think in the really early days of Moz, a lot of the time, Geraldine, my wife, who's now a James Beard Award-winning best-selling author, she would write a lot of the emails or rewrite my emails, which is kind of fun. But as the company got bigger and more formal and more corporate, that personal touch was lost. I didn't love that. Mm-hmm. With SparkToro, it's quite easy, Nikki, because there's only three of us, right? So either the email's coming from me or Amanda or very unlikely. Casey, my co-founder and our CTO, who is not as big a fan of email as Amanda and I are.
But it's funny, he's mentioned in the email.
Always. He wrote the software, like he makes the product happen. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't like, he's not in it for the glory.
That's awesome. Plus all the feedback, you know, it's probably really useful for him. So having him in the email loop, but not necessarily that sender name.
I will say one of the things that's very nice, this is something I regret from my time at Moz, is that engineers were kept sequestered from customer interactions. Mm-hmm. Initially, at sort of the request of the engineering team, they were like, well, we're bogged down. We have lots of work. You know, we don't have time to review all these things. And I should have insisted, because having Casey see every customer service request that comes in mm-hmm. has literally changed his mind about feature prioritization.
Wow.
Right. And he has come around to the idea, you know, I'll have something and I'll suggest something. And Casey will say, you know, I get all our support emails. I don't think people want that. And conversely, I'll say, hey, I really think we should prioritize this. And Casey's kind of, I don't know about that. And then a lot of support emails will come in. He'll go, I'm building it.
Wow. That's so awesome.
Yeah. Power of feedback. I don't think we could do without it.
No, for sure not. It's amazing when companies try to do it without feedback.
You know, there's this constant mantra that people repeat in startup world, talk to your customers. And all day, every day, I talk to our customers and Casey talks to our customers and Amanda talks to our customers. And it's life-changing, right? Or at least outcome-changing.
Yes.
I don't know why it's so hard to do. I think there's that like tension between wanting to just sit in a corner and build things, which is kind of the artist's way.
Yeah.
And I think there is something beautiful and something that I respect about wanting to be an artist mm-hmm. and your company, your startup, your business is your art. Your product is your art. Mm-hmm. You want to own and control that, not someone else outside. You know, art by committee is awful.
Yeah.
So I have respect for that. And also there's this nuance of it's really hard to make something that people love and want and are willing to pay for and really help them through intuition alone.
Yes. And through your own experience of, okay, this is what I want. So it must be what everyone wants.
Having that humility sometimes takes experience. I find it odd that especially the sort of venture investor class thinks that 20-year-old recent college graduates are the founders worthy of the most billions of dollars. I find that strange.
It's all about optics, right?
I think it's weird that people gave me money in my 20s, so.
But you weren't going to complain about it.
I'm grateful, but also, yeah, a few years to bake would have made a difference.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. Yeah. You really felt like a difference in experience from the few years.
Yeah. I mean, I became certainly more mature in my thinking, more emotionally resilient. You know, I had very high highs and very low lows in my 20s. I don't know if that's hormones or what it is, you know, the fact that everything was new, but also the immaturity of leadership and management, especially people management. Mm-hmm. I think that's why you get a lot of broken cultures and sort of awful experiences for employees and teams and investors and founders and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. is that there isn't a lot of emotional maturity among a ton of the, especially, this is not to single them out, but like the tech sector startup world has this youth obsession and obviously male obsession. And that doesn't always create the best cultures.
Cool. I mean, not cool, but
not cool.
Insightful. Yeah. Alrighty. Okay. So you were writing all the emails at Moz. Are you writing all the emails now for SparkToro as well?
No, I write maybe 10%, 20% of our emails that go out. Amanda writes the overwhelming majority. So she sends the email newsletter every 2 weeks, which is fairly substantive and involved and takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And she and I have combined on our onboarding sequence. A few of those emails are mostly me. A few of them are mostly her. And then occasionally we'll have a whatever special one-off email that goes out to people when we release a new feature or have a big event or something, right? We have this big event coming up in Seattle called Spark Together. And I think last year she wrote the email sequence for that. And this year I did. And
cool.
Yeah. So we kind of trade off. Depends on who's busy. She's got two kids. Sometimes they're sick, you know, and she's indisposed. And sometimes I'm traveling or working on something else. So yeah, we just tag team.
That's cool. Because from the copywriter perspective, like the consultant perspective, I'll often write emails from different team members, you know, just to give variety. And you're actually doing that. It's like the legit version.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that we try and do something that not a lot of companies, especially software as a service, you know, B2B types of companies do, which is flavor our emails and all of our content with our personalities, mm-hmm. right? So if you get an email from us, it is not going to sound very corporate and generic. At least mm-hmm. I hope it won't. If it does, mm-hmm. please hit reply and tell me so we can correct that.
Did you use AI for this? Yeah, right.
Oh my God. I want you to know that a human being wrote it, and human beings might make mistakes and grammar might not be perfect. And hopefully there's going to be some humor in there, which anyone who's ever tried to use AI to generate humor.
Impossible.
Yeah. Comedian is going to be the last job put out of business by an AI.
So true.
There's also sort of, I want to say, perspectives in there, right? Like we have mm-hmm. our unique perspective on how we see the space of digital marketing, like what we think is true in the world and what we think is good and bad, right? Mm-hmm. For example, I think monopoly power is bad. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think that Google and Meta and Microsoft and Apple and Amazon should be able to dominate the industry the way that they do. I think that's mostly a failure of antitrust. And you can feel it in my content, in my blog posts, in my emails, and in my social posts. We don't try to separate business and personal very much.
That's cool because that's an added value with the email. So yes, you're getting the actual content or the help and the, you know, onboarding tutorials and things like that. But there's so much to following a company and using a product, not just because you like the product, but because you like the builders behind the product.
Yeah.
So filtering that through is really giving that layer of value and also longevity that they're going to stick to you and be loyal to you and not just find a competitor that, you know, is a dollar a month cheaper.
Sure.
It's easy to migrate to front too, because nobody switches for a dollar a month if it's hard.
I mean, I will say we have quite a unique business in that way as well, in that SparkToro is not a lock you in type of product, right? It's a research tool.
Right.
So when you need to do the research, you go and do it. And for many of our customers, they sign up for a month or two or three, and then they quit. And then 6 months later or a year later, they come back for a few months mm-hmm. and then they quit again and then they come back. That recidivism is something that we not only enable, but encourage. Mm. If you need to save a few bucks, we'll send you an email before your billing comes up and say like, hey, if you're not using SparkToro right now, it's a good time to pause your subscription or cancel it. You can come back later. You're not going to lose any of your stuff. Mm. Research reports will be there for you whenever you want them. And that, I think, is extremely different to most, almost all venture-backed software companies, because they have to worry a lot about lifetime value of a single subscription period, because that's how they're going to raise their next round. That's how they're going to, you know, pitch the VCs, right? The VCs have all these metrics that they want you to hit mm-hmm. that are not necessarily aligned with how customers perceive value, and especially how they perceive like the kindness and generosity of the company.
Yeah, that's very refreshing. That's actual customer experience versus pretend customer experience.
Yeah. I mean, because we basically get to serve only one boss, customers,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't have these sort of other more important voices in the room telling us, hey, you need to do this for these other reasons. Like our incentives are essentially just, how do we make our customers happy and delighted?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we talked earlier about building that second company and choosing to forgo venture this time around and structuring it different, keeping the team super small, making it very personal, like all these things are in alignment and they all fit around this ethos of just wanting to run this company in sort of the way you'd run a little cafe in a small town, you know, right? Where you know all the people, they come in, if they had a good meal and they had good service, they'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not on a subscription plan. You can't lock them into spending a certain amount of money.
You must come eat here every night.
You got to have great food. Better have good diversity of food. Like the tables better be comfortable. You know, prices better be decent.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of thinking encourages companies that produce really great products and serve people well, as opposed to optimize for maximum growth rate and investor returns, which is not often correlated with making customers happy.
If you love email swipes, you will love my playbooks. They are chock full of inspiration with dozens of examples, color-coded breakdowns, and all the whys and hows and wheres and whats of all the different e-com flows. Even better, they're affordable. One anonymous copywriter said, In a world full of $1,000 and $2,000 copywriting courses, being able to learn a sequence for $52 is amazing. By the way, you can learn them for even less if you get the whole bundle. Another piece of feedback that I loved? I purchased the Welcome Sequence Playback and loved it. It's an easy, flowing read, and following it is a breeze. I love how it's so actionable. It takes you step by step through the process, but you don't end up with a templated sequence that sounds the same. I also love how you brought in relevant examples to prove the point you were making. I pull it up before every welcome sequence I write. That's a big point of these playbooks, that you don't end up with the same thing every single time, that you understand the strategy. Just like copywriter Paul Melrose says, since using Nikki's playbook, starting work on an e-commerce email sequence without the playbooks would feel like jumping out of a plane without a parachute. And these are not copy and paste solutions either. They work because Nikki gets you to understand the essential concepts at play so you can solve your own or your client's email problems. Big love and appreciation for what she's given us. Thanks, Nikki. But don't think it's all theory. Holly Williams says, had a quick turnaround deadline on an email sequence I hadn't written in a while, but I didn't even sweat it. I pulled up one of Nikki's playbooks and voila, I had a winning sequence in record time. Nikki's playbooks give you the perfect roadmap for using the data you have to craft email sequences that perform well every single time. Thanks, Nikki. I love your playbooks. And one last one, this one from a founder. I put into action the FAQ email and the 12-hour warning email you suggested, along with two other emails and two texts, and I got over $105,000 in revenue in the weekend from the promo. Pretty neat. Never made so many sales via email. Your book helped me save time to get this done. So whether you want to save time, understand things better, or just get some amazing inspiration, go grab a playbook, or two, or 12, at nikkialbus.com/email-playbooks. And yes, that link is in the show notes. Wish you were in e-com just so that you could grab my playbooks, but you're in SaaS? Don't worry, I got your back with the SaaS Success Pack. Say that 5 times fast. Okay, don't. Just head to the show notes. You'll find the link and grab it there. Okay, back to our show. So I guess where does this feedback request fit into all that? Both the overall email onboarding and then also, I mean, it's pretty clear where it fits into in this ethos is you want to hear what the customers have to say.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's like, it helps with the classic things, right? It definitely helps with prioritization and which product features to build. It lets us know where people are frustrated or having problems. It also tells us when we're going in the right or wrong direction. We can very clearly feel slight context. SparkToro, or the original version in 2020 when we launched, was built on Twitter data. Fast forward a couple of years and Twitter gets bought. And the result of that is two things. One, some of the APIs that we used were taken away. And so we couldn't get data from them. We could still crawl Twitter plenty easily. And so we could have gotten that data. But the other problem was that the Twitter ecosystem became, it went from a place where individual communities had lots of conversations around their community topics. So for example, you know, you could go to gardening Twitter and see lots of people talking about gardening and different plants and, I don't know, weed killers and whatever the topics were. So what we found, because we were basically monitoring like every post from, you know, 100 million plus accounts, was that 60 to 70% of the conversation that had been topically relevant and was interesting for audience research purposes had become just the topic du jour.
It kind of became like news headline-y where people were just...
Yeah.
This is what's in the news, quote unquote. So that's what we're talking about versus all our additional interests.
Exactly. Exactly. So Twitter just became this like not a place for niche communities to congregate and chat about their thing, but sort of a place where almost everyone was commenting on what was going on with Twitter itself, with Elon himself, with whatever issue he or sort of the Twitterverse was surfacing, a lot of like media, you know, popular media and news stuff. Twitter had always had a heavy component of that, but it became overwhelmingly dominant and we lost a lot of those other conversations. The biggest problem for us, especially, was that people stopped following new people in their little communities. And so even when those gardeners were having relevant conversations, you know, if a new gardening source emerged, Twitter wouldn't be the place that they'd go anymore. They wouldn't build a community on Twitter anymore. So I'm making this short story too long. We moved off of Twitter last year, built a new data set that is structured around clickstream data. So we work with Datos, who has a large clickstream panel, global clickstream panel, about 10 million users in the panel here in the US. And then search data from Google and social data primarily from LinkedIn this time. And so connecting up those sources proved to be challenging, but Casey managed to do it. We launched that early this year. The frustrating part was when we launched it, initially we built it just for the US, and then the plan is roll out other countries. And we have seen an overwhelming number of customer service emails, support emails, inquiries. When are you coming to the UK? When are you coming to Canada? Wow. When are you coming to Israel? When are you coming to France? When are you coming to Germany? When are you coming to Japan? And so basically, we've been able to categorize those, and we know UK and Canada are the ones that people request the most. And so we're going to try and have those prioritized in the next 60 days. Casey basically threw out a bunch of other priorities, put those in front.
Wow.
You know, that's really from feedback.
Right. I was going to say feedback. That's so cool.
Super useful.
So this feedback request, does it go out often? Does it go out more than once to the same customer? Does it go out in a specific slot in the cycle?
I believe it goes out in a slot in the cycle to both new and recurring customers. So for example, if you signed up last year for a couple months and then you canceled your subscription, you became a subscriber again this year, you would get that email again asking for feedback.
Cool. Which fits in very much with how people use it. Like you mentioned, people are always canceling and starting and canceling and starting. Nice. Very cool.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess when you were thinking about writing this email, what was the creation process like? Because there's a couple different parts to it. I guess we'll start nitpicking it. The first thing I found interesting is the two questions that you decided to ask two questions instead of just one. But then I was studying it more, and they're kind of one question depending on who you are. So it's kind of like if you're type A, you answer one. If you're type B, then you answer two. Was that your thought?
I would say some intentionality around that.
Cool.
It wasn't the full conceit of the email, but as I was writing it, I think that came to the forefront as being useful. And I mean, the overarching vision here was I want to maximize the rate of response while not asking people to give feedback that they didn't feel was critical or key, right? So I'm not trying to push you like, hey, everybody, you need to reply no matter what. You've got to tell me something. I don't need that, right? I am trying to get as many responses to the, is there something important? Was there something missing? Is there a problem? Something holding you back? Something you wish that you saw? Something you particularly love? Those kinds of responses I am trying to elicit.
It's interesting. It's almost like you're feeding bias into the email. Like, ignore this if you have a middle of ground, not super important feedback to give. Cool.
Yeah.
That's really smart. So in my version, which was from a while ago, it also has the feature updates. Do you put that in constantly, or is that something that only happens?
I think we revisit that every like 6 to 9 months. So right now there's three new features inside SparkToro, the V2 that I just talked about. Those three new features are not included in the email yet, and they will be probably after the summer. We have like two more features. So we don't update it every time we release something new, but kind of in a batch.
That's so cool. Because it's always a struggle when you're doing evergreen emails. Like, how can you put the updated stuff? So that's cool that you're revisiting it whenever, you know, from time to time.
Yeah, but when they're substantive. Yeah.
Yes. Substantive. And also when it's sustainable, that you're not going in every single time you launch a little bug fix, you know?
So yeah. I mean, that would be
a little intense.
Our team is too small to do something like that.
Yes. But it's also their overall features, you know, and you're catching everyone. So it's like, oh, I saw that one, but I didn't see that one. So it's a great win back to throw into the feedback, especially now that you mentioned that for the people who are kind of just in the middle ground, you know, you'll catch them with new features. And if that value is not there to give feedback, it's there to check out new features. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, I think that this is part of the way that we get past customers to think about us again. Right, is to give them that heads up. And we're privileged that a huge percent of our subscribers also subscribe to the email newsletter. So that's a place where every time there's a new feature, we call it out.
That's great. My favorite part, though, is the PS about the pasta recipes.
I get a not insubstantial number of replies to that part in particular.
Because it's that human connection.
Yeah. And it's fun too, right?
Yes.
You know, someone will reply and be like, oh, I love this. And I'll reply with, no. You cannot make spaghetti alla carbonara with cream. You must, you use the bain-marie over the boiling water to like get the right texture with the egg mixture. And you don't need any cream, I promise.
But cream always makes everything better. not this.
Oof. I mean, as someone who's lactose intolerant, that's not so much.
So that's pretty cool. Good tip. So what kind of responses do you get aside from, you know, pasta requests and like aside from the feature requests or things like that?
Yeah.
Just more emotional requests, things that kind of tap you into the customer mindset. What kind of or relationship, I guess.
I think one thing that helps us a lot is when we see this is a little bit second order, but one thing that we really like to look at is who is replying around a particular topic. This was true a couple of years ago. We saw a lot of agencies talking about user management, which wasn't something we had enabled. And that was clearly a feature that, or like a missing feature that needed to be built. And so that became a priority because we saw those people replying and because we noticed that we were getting more agency signups. Mm. And similarly, this is not to say we dismiss feedback, but when we get feedback from what I'd call like non-right fit types of customers, we worry about that less. For example, we've had a healthy number of requests for SOC 2 compliance, but we are an enterprise software company. We don't serve enterprises. Mm-hmm. We are very inexpensive, right? There's a free version, a $50 a month version, $150, and then $300 a month is the most that we'll charge anybody. So, you know what? We just don't worry about those kinds of things or being able to take payment via wire or being able to take payment via bank transfers or you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I know that that's how big companies do things, but we're not a serving big company, right? Go pay Brandwatch 50 grand a month, whatever it is they charge. I think it's more like 50 grand a year, but still, you know, very different, you know, an order of magnitude or two above the SparkToro pricing. And so we don't really think of ourselves in competition with those folks. And we also don't think about ourselves as prioritizing those types of customers. Mm-hmm. So that data is really interesting when we get the reply, right? It'll say like account exec at IBM or Wells Fargo or something. And we kind of go, well, it's not that we're not taking your feedback. If you have product feedback, like we're into it. Mm-hmm. But if it's structural stuff, we don't worry as much about those as we would with small, medium business, small agency, consulting group, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really knowing who your customers are and not trying to serve everybody.
Yeah, I don't think you can serve everybody, right? Mm-hmm. I think especially at our size, like our ability to focus is strongly correlated with our ability to serve the right customers well. And I'd much rather serve a smaller group really well than everyone a little bit worse.
Yeah. It's just important in general when you get feedback, being able to prioritize it and say, okay, this is not coming from enough people. This is not coming from the right people. And although it's so emotionally, I mean, I find anytime I see feedback, it's like, yes, we'll do it. No, we can't wait. Even just like giving clients feedback, you know, it's like, wait, we should change that. And they're like, we can't. That will take our dev teams like 6 months. It's like, but a customer wants it.
I'm just preparing myself. I'm like psyching myself up for all the feedback that we're going to get with the video game because that, that's a whole nother
ball game for sure.
Sector, right? And it's super interesting, Nikki, because the whole job of a B2B software product is reduce friction, remove challenge, make it so that less effort equals more impact. And a video game is introduce intentional challenge, add friction to places so that you create fun. And that is it's a fascinating way to build software, right? Because video games are essentially a piece of software, but it's not, it's, you know, it's the opposite of what I've been doing the rest of my career. So it's a challenge. Yeah.
That's such a cool mental shift and perspective. So it should be fun to use awful software because it's basically a video game.
Yeah. I'm not sure that when they designed it poorly, they intentionally thought about the fun you would have resolving that friction.
Chatting support 15 times.
How do I get Slack to integrate with Outlook? And why can't I get this email to go here? Yeah, I don't think they were talking about like, oh, well, let's make that a really joyful experience. And like, add some juicy graphics that like show up when you can't get it going.
Like that awful spinning circle.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually only on Mac, right?
We'll have Clippy, the villain, come in and
I am ruining your day now. Any other changes to this email that you tweak from time to time aside from the product updates?
One thing I'm trying to do, this will probably be in a future update, I want to make every email shorter. Yeah, I think that length is correlated with the bad kind of friction. I also think that even a personal email from a human being asking you for something and it's your friend, if you see a few paragraphs, you're like, oh, I just don't know. Let me get to this later. Let me worry about it later. Mm-hmm. I would love to see us be able to communicate all the key things we need to communicate in 3 lines, 4 lines, a few bullet points. Mm-hmm. And maybe we might even do the thing where we have the most salient, most important critical piece in the email. And then that a link to some, whatever, a blog post or help article or something with more details about stuff.
Or a follow-up email. It could be a second email.
Yeah, because the attention spans will never go up, right? They only go down over time.
Okay, that transitions very nicely. Which emails catch your attention in your inbox that, you know, you have the attention for them? What emails do you like to swipe from or read and get inspired by?
Gosh, a wide variety, actually. So I'm an email addict. I love email. I think it's great. I love that it lets me prioritize everything in one place. I hate getting messages on like LinkedIn or, my God, I checked my Twitter DMs, I don't know, a month ago and I felt terrible. You know, there's people who DM'd me a year ago.
Wow.
Having everything come to that one place is fantastic for me. And I appreciate emails that have done their homework on who I am. Mm. You know, this is something that I wish we could do more of in SparkToro. I think we're trying to get there with more by asking more questions when people sign up about who they are so that we can personalize and segment emails more. Amanda actually was working on a sequence that sends separate emails to people who run an agency versus work as a consultant in an agency versus work in-house versus run an in-house team versus are their own creator.
Oh, it's so beautiful to hear.
Yeah. Because I think being able to speak personally to the problems and challenges is huge. So when I get an email that says, hey, you know, I've read a bunch of your blog posts, I watched a bunch of your videos, I think this thing is going to be interesting to you. Those tend to be, when they've really done the work and it's not just a line, those tend to be the ones that get my attention, even if they're from a salesperson, right? Even if somebody's just cold selling me, if they've done their homework and it shows and it's personal and it is, well, with me, I can handle even medium length or longer emails, probably more effective when it's shorter.
I'm going to send you a whole novel next.
I get a lot of those. I have long email conversations with people about things and yeah, it works fine for me. I'm very rare. This is not advice. Do not write your emails for people like me. There's like one of me.
But it is advice in write your emails for who you're writing it for.
Absolutely.
If you're a novel person, you need a novel email.
Yeah. My theory is no one who enjoys a long email will be angry that they got a shorter one that communicated the same thing.
Yep. Makes sense. Yes. All right. Thanks so much. This was very enlightening, both in the email space and also just the startup world and building companies and customer feedback and all that. So customer experience, I guess. So thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for joining me for Email Story Time. If you enjoyed today's story, give this podcast a review so email marketers like you can have more fun with email. See you next week when we dig into this story's takeaways.